Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in this room tonight, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe it's only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that we will be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too, I must have this thing. Tonight we have Von K. here from Skyland, and he's been sober since 85.
December 5th,
my son's birthday. He was 7 years old when you got sober. Come on in.
Hello, my name's Von. I'm an alcoholic. It's a pleasure to be here. And tell you, it really feels good to be sober today. I've worked in my yard all day today and thinking about this meeting today I was going to be at, and thinking of all day of how blessed I've been and how good it felt working in the yard today, being sober and enjoying this pretty day. And but anyway, my sobriety date is December 5th of 1985. But I came here a few years before that. But anyway, I was born and raised here in the Atlanta area. Born in Dorville, grew up in the Dorville-Shamley area. And I grew up in a alcoholic home. I actually grew up in an alcoholic neighborhood. And alcoholism ran pretty rapid in my whole entire family. I had my grandfather committed suicide from drinking. I had an uncle committed suicide, and three cousins. So I never thought about that toward the end of my using, but I know that at some point at the end of my drinking and stuff, that the alcohol and drugs quit working, and I was in a desperate place. When I first got into fellowship, though, I talked to my mother about the program and started talking to her about the issues I'd been working on, and one of them was the hell I went through as a child, because my mother didn't drink until later on in my life, but my father was the most loving person in the world. But when he was like the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, I don't know, a couple of days went by and she'd call me and she was laughing like hell. And she said, you know, when you came into this world, and the damn doctor that delivered you was drunk. You know, and she said, that's why you're like you are. I says, what do you mean? She says, well, when you came out back in the days, I was born in downtown Shamley, and if you was born in Shamley, Dr. Carr delivered you. He'd been in a cocktail party or something or other, but she said, he dropped you about two times, and then when he pulled out that knife to circumcise you, he dropped that knife about two times. And he said, I'd jump out of bed and I'd beat him in the head with the band pin. So I got my first nursing while my mother was strapped to a bed. But that's how my mother was. She was meaner than hell. And she's the woman that raised me. And she was very strict and very loving. I loved my mother. But my father, on the other hand, like I say, he was the most loving person you'd ever want to know. And this is, I guess, would kind of describe my father. And when I got old enough, he took me down to, we had creeks and stuff behind our house. He took me down to the creek, showed me how to catch salamanders, and I could sell these and make a dollar. And he just taught me and showed me how to make money. There wasn't allowances in our family. And in doing that, I got attacked by a rat, big cottonmouth one time, and I was kind of proud of killing that thing. It was about 6 foot long, you know, and I took it home to show up my mother, and she about fainted, you know. And when my father got home, they got in a big argument about that, and what he did later is he went out and bought me my first gun, and he taught me how to shoot that gun. We'd spend time together, and he taught me how to take care of myself and defend myself. And for me, that was all the education I got. It was beat all the education I needed. And but anyway, as I continued to grow up, I don't know, I kind of grew up around being kind of was a neighborhood errand boy. I always fixed people's houses up for them. The man I took after growing up was my next door neighbor. He was a carpenter. And so from a very early age, I just fell in love with carpenter work, and that's what I would pursue my whole life, and that's what I've chosen to do for a living since. And I knew at an early age that's what I wanted to do. And for me, it's always kind of been an asset, because there's still people today trying to figure out what the hell they want to do with their lives, you know. And for me, I knew early on that this is what I wanted to do. So really, as far as school went, I had really no interest much in school. My interest was in, as long as I could be building something, doing something, or working, I was happy. And but once I did get into school, I remember. It took them about 30 minutes to get me off the damn school bus. I wasn't coming off that school bus. And I was just petrified being bussed off the school. I remember they got this really pretty girl to come to the door and talk me off that bus. And I've been a sucker for pretty women ever since, I tell you. But anyway, I was very shy and very, I don't know where it came from, but that's just the way I was. I was very shy and just was just petrified of people for a long time. They put me through all kind of programs to try to get me to overcome that. But anyway, father's drinking got really worse and worse and worse, and all the things we did in my early childhood, you know, I seen him. He started selling his guns, selling his bows, and drinking just kind of pretty much took over his life, and he was almost drinking on a daily basis, and he became a very violent person. And it's kind of like he was always beating on my mother. I had two older sisters, and I think one of the things I picked up from all that, and it's affected me my whole life, is I was always protecting my mother and sisters and stuff. And I started playing in a young child as a rescuer role. And so for most of my whole entire life and adult life, and how it affected me in relationships with other women, I always seeked out women I could rescue, you know, and that was just setting me up for failure. And I was always failing in relationships, because in trying to play that role, you're always trying to control people's lives and control their behaviors and all this, that, and the other. But we ended up moving from that neighborhood when I was about 11 years old into another neighborhood where there was more kids by my age, and I got introduced at around 11 years old, and my first drug was actually sniffing glue. I need to back up for a minute too. And being the way I raised up, my mother and father in our house, if you were sick for any common cold or illness, we were fed a hot toddy, which was bourbon and warm water, sugar, I don't know, honey, whatever. And my grandfather was a moonshiner, so we generally always was drinking his liquor. And I can just remember growing up, the older I got, the sicker I got. I stayed sick all the time. I could say I was sick, fixing my hot toddy. But anyway, but 11 years old, I started sniffing glue. I think I was in the sixth grade of school, and don't know where that came from. But then later on, as I got on into high school, my father's drinking got really worse, and he ended up losing our house, losing his job, and my mother had come down with breast cancer, and she'd been struggling with that for about 2 years. And when she, for some reason, she started drinking. And so that was just like a nightmare from hell. Now I had nobody to turn to. And, but anyway, they both got to where they couldn't take care of me. Two older sisters and a younger sister. And my two older sisters had enough sense to leave. I didn't. And my younger sister went somewhere to stay with an aunt. And I was just left going and staying with different people's friends. I was living with different people's friends of mine. And I'm just trying to get this last 2 or 3 months of school in. So I went from one little foster parent to the next. And they had a hard time coping with me. They'd come wake me up for school. I was always stuck to the floor. From I was sniffing glue always at night. And wake me up, I was stuck to something. And they didn't know quite know how to handle me. And so I got into high, going on further in the high school. I was really active in sports and stuff. I loved sports. And finally, I one of the my friend's parents found one of my aunt's family's, and I was going to have to go stay with her out in Fairbanks, and that really pissed me off. I was just rebellious. I was just alcohol kept taking from me my whole life, and then the school I was going to, and football team. It was the first time I'd ever felt a part of something, and very actively involved in the sports, and I felt that being taken away from me. And I went out there, and she was kind enough to let me come home on the weekends and take the bus, and I'd come visit with my friends and all. And I ran into a friend of my father's back who knew all about what happened to the family and all. And he had offered to become my legal guardian so I could continue to go to the school I loved and continue to play sports and all that. And so my aunt agreed to that. And I moved in with Mac and worked for Mac, but he you know, he was a mechanic and stuff, and I didn't like that stuff. I liked doing carpet work, and this kind of stuff I enjoyed doing. One day I had worked for Mac, you know, help him open the station in the morning, go to school, work, play football, come home from school, work, and it was just, I was always working. And I came in one night, and my friends from I played football with had dropped me off the station so I could go to work. And they always said to me, they said, "We wish we had a life like you did." And I said, "What's that?" And they said, "Well, hell, you can just come and go like you want. You can just, you know, do what you want to." They said, "Well, hell, we got to go home." And, man, that just broke my heart. Wishing I could go home, but I was fixing to have to go to work. And so I went there, and Mac had this huge Exxon station, and he started back in the late 60s, and he started hiring these beautiful women to pump gas, and they'd come to work in their little hot pants and have their butt hanging out. And I became, from being a gas tenant to a flagman, flagging all the men, because we had a hell of a gas service. And I tell you, but Mona, when she came in, Mona, she says, "Mac went there." I said, "Where's Mac?" She said, "He's not here." And he said, "But he wants you to stay here tonight and work and he closed the station." She says, "Clean the station up." She said, "Exxon was threatening to shut him down because the place was so dirty and all this, that, and the other. And he wanted you to stay here and clean it." And I was so tired. I said, "There's no way I can do this." And she says, "Well, you got to do it." She says, "And it doesn't look like you'll be able to make it through tonight." She says, she handed me these 3 pills. And she says, "But don't you take but one of these." And you see, I was really depressed from what my friends had just told me. And I really didn't want to be there. And so I took one of them pills, and all of a sudden, hair started tingling, and feet started tingling, and all of a sudden I've got this burst of energy. I don't know where it came from, but I had, it was kind of like a spiritual experience. I said, "Oh my God," you know, and man, I went around and started working, cleaning that damn place up, and the way I started from the very first pill, I said, "Damn, if this one will do this with these other two, well," you know, and that's the way I use it. And that for me became to be my drug of choice, because one of the feelings I stayed in the most was I seemed to always be depressed, and amphetamines and stuff would take me out of that. And that morning, I was running out of that stuff, and the first thing I went to do was find Mona. And I went and found Mona, and she came out to the door wearing nothing but a t-shirt. She said, "I knew you'd be here." And but anyway, I was 15 years old then. I went from being 15 to 25 in just a matter of a few hours. But then it wasn't long after that that I started kind of experimenting with drinking. And we were having a big pep rally at school. And big bonfire and all that stuff. And I remember starting to drink beer. And from the time I ever started drinking beer, I always, for some reason, blacked out. And so when I had my first drink, when I came to, my high school sweetheart had me under her arm. Her sister had me under one arm. And somehow or another, I ended up over in some gay guy's house. Now, I don't know how I ended up there, but it was humiliating. I got outside, all the football teams out there, Doraville police is out there. I don't know what in the hell happened. Don't want to know. But you would think a normal person would quit drinking after that. But what I did, I went and got me an ice pick. I put more holes in my belt. And I'd start wearing my belt real tight. Whenever I went to do something, I'd wear my belt tight. And even, as things went on, I was always looking for that special belt, and I was always afraid when I put alcohol or drugs in my body, what might happen. And anytime I'd ever go into a bar or something, I'd always tighten my belt up about four notches. You know, I might wake up at your place with my damn pants ain't coming off. Right? And as the 60s rolled along, you know, I moved out from Max, you know, and I got started involved in all kinds of drugs. I started getting involved in drugs and narcotics and heroin and all kinds of stuff. And it just happened so quick. And before I'm 16 years old, I've already started robbing out drug stores. I'm robbing animal hospitals. I'm robbing doctor's offices and everything. But up on the strip there was, you know, they started opening these leather shops up. And I'm always seeking out this special belt. I found this belt. It had holes all the way around it. It had three little latches. It had a little hash pipe on it. You latch it over and bolt it down. And that belt was not coming off. But see, that those things, with that, sometimes worked against me. And I came to one time. I remember meeting some people on the strip. I was always selling dope. And I came to, and I was in Pensacola, Florida. And I woke up, and there was a naked girl to my right, and there was a naked girl to my left. And I looked over at them, and they said, "We tried to take your pants off, but we couldn't get your belt loose." But anyway,
So I went to check these girls out, and as they were bending my fingers back, these two naked guys jumped out of the bathroom, and I'd never seen any of these people. And I'm the next I know that the whole room was full of marijuana, and I fixed them up with this drug deal, and I don't remember any of it. You know, but I grew up with this work ethic, and I've always worked a job through all this stuff, and I demanded them to take my ass back to Atlanta. You know, and they did so. But anyway, but when, after meeting those two girls and those two guys, I realized the first time I'd ever been screwed over. Oh, no. Bad one. But anyway, but my drug use really got excelled, and I was nearing 18 years old, and I hadn't seen my parents for about 4 years, and I was hitchhiking somewhere up, going up to Virginia to a music festival, and I kept getting. Preacher had picked me up, and I was telling him about how I had been hallucinating things about my parents, and I did hallucinate all the time on drug use and stuff. And he suggested maybe I go. All I knew was that they were in Knoxville, and I went and found my parents, and went to. And he got me turned around, and somehow I was so screwed up, I managed to find my parents in Knoxville, and they for their first time was going into a drug rehabilitation place themselves up in Knoxville, and my aunt and uncle up there thought, well, I just should go right in there with them, but they wouldn't accept me into that hospital, and I'd been doing a lot of heroin and narcotics at that time, and my aunt and uncle locked me in the attic of their house, and they kept me up there, and they talked me off of that stuff, and took me back when I got my health back, and try to stay up there, but it's like I said, my love for carpenter work, there was just no carpenter work up there, and I just kept insisting I come back to Atlanta, and they fought that tooth and nail, but I did. I came back to Atlanta. I went back a week, and I always stayed and lived in boarding houses, places like that. I was at this boarding house, and I really started fearing my life. Wondering, for me, a bottom was when tomorrow looks worse than today, and wondering, wishing I hadn't quit school, and wishing I had done that, and thinking back of my childhood and the kid I was, and what was becoming of me, and I just didn't want to continue to live on the way I was living. And I started praying to God then for help then, and I started going to church, and nothing I heard in church could change the way I felt. And people were suggesting I get married, so I thought, well, I met this girl, Julie, who I loved dearly, and she had a little boy, Alex, kind of already had a little already made family, and we got married, and I went through a little short period of time there where I stayed off drugs, but I drank daily and smoked dope daily, but I stayed off the hard stuff, and I was only married a short time, and I realized the hell she liked to do dope, and I'm always trying to make extra money and selling dope on the side, so the next thing I know, I'm back into selling drugs, and before long, I'm back into the narcotics and stuff, and then things changed for me. I was getting too scared and paranoid. I got where I was so pissed off at myself. I was thinking of myself as a failure, and I was just on a rampage. I just went out and started armed robbing drugstores. You never know how sick you are or how hooked you are on drugs until you run out. And I always managed to get drugs in whatever way possible. Anyway, when I started armed robbing drug stores, that they come looking for your ass. And Anyway, I can remember when they finally did come and arrest me. Then today they came and arrested me. I actually felt rescued. And they try to get me into these methadone programs and stuff that they had in the jails and stuff. And I just tell them, I said, I don't want anymore. You know, and while in jail, that was the first time I started going through convulsions and withdrawals and stuff in jails. And they would take me out of my jail cell 3 or 4 times a day and give me shots of morphine, Demerol, and detox me from all the stuff I'd been doing. But nobody was doing that for my wife, Julie. And my sister, Denise, come and told me about how she started prostituting and all, support her drug habit and stuff. And then I couldn't believe my sister told me something like that, but it just about ripped my heart out. And sitting in jail, I've not been able to do anything, but I always believed in God, and I started praying to God to help her. And it wasn't long after that I got pulled out of my jail cell and told the news that she had been killed in a car wreck. She had nodded out from heroin and hit a telephone pole and killed her instantly. And for me, I was relieved that she didn't have to go continue to live in the hell she was living in. And I felt so responsible for that and guilty for it for most of my life. But anyway, I ended up spending three and a half years in prison over all that stuff. And while I was in prison, I was able to finish high school and went through all kind of camps and drug programs and stuff there. And they ended up sending me to a drug release program. Well, there, went through all kinds of therapy there, but from there they sent me back to prison. From there, they had thrown me there, but I went out and they started giving me passes. They said one of the rules was you couldn't go anywhere around alcohol or even be around anybody who could drink and drug. I said, well, I can't go nowhere. Now, all my friends, you know, I couldn't even go to my mother and father's house because they drank. And so I ended up going to a movie and met some people while I was at the movie, and they fixed me up with a date on my foreign pass. And me and this girl, now I had been locked up for 3 years. We laid up for about 11 hours, I think. And I got back to that place. They swore up down I'd been using drugs. And they sent me back to prison for that. And for me, it was the worst thing to them, because for 3 years they kept me in a maximum security prison where I was able to stay straight, and they sent me to this county camp where they could get just about anything you wanted to. And I stayed there, did my last 9 months there, and they released me from prison in Coweta County in 1973, 1976, I mean. And I went to my parents' house, and the first thing my father said to me, they had moved back to Atlanta, and he says, you cannot stay here. And I've got a $25 check. These guys were having a party across the street, across the hall. So I popped my head in over there, and they were drinking that Mad Dog 2020. And that's, once I take alcohol and drink it, no telling what's going to happen. And when I came to, I was, first time I ever came to from a blackout, woke up in a bar. The worst place I could have woke up to, because I woke up in a bar where all these people I used to rob drugs for were there. All these people were giving me dope, all this stuff, and going to help me get back on my feet. And a friend of mine gave me a small suitcase of narcotics. When he came to get his money, I barricaded myself and I was standing like so. I was living in Bornet. I thought I was in a German whorehouse. I was hallucinating all these girls running around. And he was a childhood friend. And Tommy knew, he didn't know what the hell to do, so he took me to my parents. And now my mother's quit drinking. My father still drank, my mother quit drinking. They take me to Grady Hospital. And I get to Grady Hospital, they bring me up to the 13th floor. And then up ward. I would visit that floor 7 more times. And I'd go to jail 7 more times. In Theolis, I kept desperately trying to change my ways. I met this girl, Rebecca, who was the first person woman I ever had in my life who didn't drink or drug. But the night I met her, we was in a nightclub, and I was sitting over there, and she was drinking this beer all night long. She'd been sitting drinking. I said, "What? It's just 2 hours went by." She just sipped a little bit out, and I just kept thinking there was something wrong. I wanted to go over and buy her a beer. And she says, "Well, I don't really drink." She says, "I just she just moved here. She had just moved to Atlanta from Auburn. She was an Auburn graduate. She taught. She was a school teacher there, and so she was wanting to leave. She didn't know what area of town she was in. I said, "Listen, let me walk you to your car." She said, "I'll be fine." I said, "No, you won't." I said, "You're in a bad area of town." And so she let me walk her to her car. And I had already planned. I was planning on going fishing more, and I was already trying to grasp back on my life as I had it as a child. Days where I used to love to go fishing and love to do things. And I wanted to try and trying to get all these things back in my life. So I invited her fishing, and she laughed like hell. She says, "I don't know who in the hell you are. I think you're crazy as hell, but I've never had anybody ask me on my first date to go fishing." You know, and she agreed. And I didn't have a car, and she come pick me up, and we went fishing. And we caught fish all day long. We went home, cooked fish, we had sex, and I moved in. And that's just the way it was. But I tell you, and I started living a good life there for a couple of years. But she was the first person I had to start lying to. I never had to lie or cover up my drinking and use it. Hide my money where I've been spending it. And she never questioned that. But she always gave her my fair share of what it took. But one morning she laid over to me and she looked me square in the face. She says, "I think you might have a drinking problem." I says, "How's that?" She says, "Well, you peed in the house last night." I said, "Well, hell, everybody pees in the house every now and then." She says, "But not in the silverware drawer." But I didn't start noticing one thing that concerned me in her. And since that morning it was brought up, I sat down and talked to her about my past and who she was really with. And all the years we'd already been together, how I was been lying to her and all. And what she had started doing, she had started, eventually started drinking and doing cocaine to control my drinking and using. And I told her about my ex-wife, Julie, the things that had happened and how I felt about it. And I said, I couldn't see this happening to you, and I could see it happening to you. And I told her I wanted some help, and I was going to get some help, and if I couldn't stop drinking and using, I was going to leave her. So she got me this appointment over at this place called Derek. I went over there, and all intentions of being helped. I went over there, and they wanted to keep me for 30 days. Hell, I can't do that. I'd have to quit my job. It was a black man. He laughed like hell. He said, "Well, they have an outpatient program here that'd be good for you." I said, "Well, sign me up for that." And he said, I said, what time I have to be here for that? He says, between 9 and 2. I said, well, hell, I can't be here for that. I'd have to quit my job. And he says, well, it just happens to be Tuesday night. He says, tonight at 8 o'clock, there's some people that meet upstairs here that has the same similar problem you do. Maybe you'd be interested in coming and going to that meeting and seeing if that would help you or not. And I went to that meeting. I smoked me a big old joint going there, put it out, and went up to my... I didn't know it at the time, but I was at my very first Narcotics Anonymous meeting. I went up out of that meeting, I never forget that overwhelming feeling I had of how somebody knows. I thought I was the only person who did the crazy things I did and all that. And I got my white chip and was so sincere about it. But got down in my truck, I was so clueless. I finished smoking the rest of the joint on the way home. And I got home and my using continued, and I kept my promise to Julie and Rebecca, I mean. And I left, and I went for about 3 or 4 months, just went batshit crazy. And I remember my mother and father found me somewhere downtown Atlanta, and somewhere in some alley. How they found me, I don't know. And my mother was just really beside herself. And she said, we're fixing to have your ass committed. And I said, well, Mom, I said, what good will that do? Well, son, you're crazy in hell. You need to be locked up in a padded cell somewhere. I said, Mother, I said, I've been through all that shit. And I said, I've been talking to counselors and that, and none of that's ever helped. And she said, well, we can have your ass locked up in jail. She said, we've looked into all of this. I said, well, Mother, I said, what good will that do? I said, I've been in and out of jail my whole life. You would think what drugs and alcohol has put me through, a normal person would quit. I said, Mom, I don't know why I'm like I am. And I told her, I said, Mom, and I've tried everything. And I said, Mom, it'll take an act of God for me to ever stop drinking. Because I've tried it all, and I don't know what to do. And it wasn't long after that I guess it was about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I was somewhere down on Chester Bridge Road, and I'd been on a big long cocaine run, drinking and all. And I felt myself up the top of the street about 3 o'clock in the morning, not knowing how I got up there. And I climbed down from that tree, and coming down, well, I don't know how I got up there, but coming down was not easy. I scratched myself all the hell, and I got all the dope, the syringes and stuff I had, and I threw that stuff as far as I could throw it. I didn't want any more of it. And I hugged that tree, and I prayed to God to free me from the hell I'd been living in my whole life. And about 5 minutes later, I was crawling on my hands and knees with a big ladder, looking through the woods, looking for that shit I'd just thrown away. And, of course, I found it. In doing so, I ripped my clothes off, scratched myself all to hell, and went to my parents' house to petrify my mother, scare my mother to death one more time. And so my father barricaded me in the house, put my furniture up against the door, and wouldn't let me out. And my younger sister, Denise, come over, crawled through the door, yelling, if I had a gun, I'd shoot your ass, all that sort of stuff. And she had his phone number. And she says, call this fucking number. And so I called his phone number. And this guy says, I can't understand a damn thing you're saying. That was pretty screwed up. And he said, do you think you can go through the rest of the day without drinking and call me back tomorrow? I said, yeah, I've been barricaded in my parents' house. I can't get out. And anyway, I remember that phone call took me a little while to where he could understand anything I was saying. And one thing he asked me, he says, you ever thought about stopping drinking and drugging? I said, yes, I have. I said, but I tried everything and I can't. And we got real quiet there for a second. He said, I did. And I asked him about how he did it, and he talked to me about this fellowship. And he talked to me a little bit about what his life used to be like and what he went through. And he asked me if I thought I'd be interested in it. And I said, yes, I would. I told him, I said, I don't know. I said, the only way I think that I'll ever be able to stop if somebody will just chain me to a wall and lock me up in a room somewhere. And I said, I just need someplace safe and secure to be. And he said, we got a room that you can stay in. But he said, we ain't going to lock you up, chain you up. And so I went to this place. And he said, you're going to have these two guys meet me there. And those two friends of mine are still sober today. And probably be the only two people I ever helped get sober. But I met Danny's guys, kept me back in his back room. And I don't know, I seem like I've been in there for about a week or so, and I wanted to come out of that room, and they wanted me to come out of this room and into this meeting. And I couldn't do it. I looked like Charles Manson. And so it was something I was incapable of doing on my own. And so some other people come in there, and they wanted me to come out to this meeting. And so I go out into this meeting, and just so petrified of people. And they had these little poles around in the meeting. And so I thought, well, I'll get in behind this pole and hide behind this pole. And I got to looking around in the room, and hell, I knew half the people sitting in the meeting. You know, and I got some people I'd always wondered what happened to them, and what happened to them is they got sober. And these people I thought, and I'd have to say my very first meeting, my whole attitude up in life was that I can't. And I thought that I never would be able to start drinking and drugging. When I seen these people and talking to this guy on the phone, my attitude changed that maybe I can. But anyway, that was my introduction. But it still took me a couple more years of being in and out of this program. And I had accumulated almost a year of sobriety at one time, and then relapsed from drinking. I didn't know I relapsed from it, but from drinking alcohol, and I'd gotten hurt on a job, and a friend of mine from work that came over had some cocaine, and I'd been drinking that nighttime cold medicine, and I knew that cocaine, when I was in so much pain, I knew that stuff would take that pain away, and it took me 9 months to quit. And it was 9 months of pure hell because I had already gotten a heart full of this program and a belly full of booze. And I'm going to run over about 10 minutes if you folks don't mind. And so, and I didn't know what had happened. When I realized I was a president of this clubhouse, I was involved in the service work. I was just doing everything I possibly needed. And what I was doing at the time was keeping me sober, but I wasn't working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't working the steps, just staying sober on service work. And so December 5th, 1985, I was laying on the floor of my parents' bathroom, and my father came in there and said, "Son, you want me to just shoot you?" I said, "No, Dad." I said, "Just give me the phone." And I made a phone call to the same guy I had talked to when I was barricaded in my... And he suggested that I go to this place in Conyers. Now, if you reflect back on the time that I went to DAC and they were wanting me to quit my job and all this other stuff, now I was still working. I had a job. I was making almost $2,000 a week. So all of it was going to drugs and alcohol. And he finally got through to me that there really wasn't anything more important than being sober. And for me, that day, December 5th, 1985, there was nothing more important. And that job was no concern to me no more. All my earthly belongings were no longer important to me. And I gave up all that to go down to Congress. And then while I was down there, I knew I was a drug addict. I hadn't even thought about whether or not I was an alcoholic or I even had a drinking problem. And while I was down there, I never had the opportunity to go to any kind of detox place. And so I was down there in downtown Conyers talking about my drug addiction and the cravings I was going through hell with in an AA meeting. And well, they don't take kind to that. And a lot of folks around here don't. You know, and so when I got back to the house, Brad just says, "Man," he says, "Vaughn," he says, "we've got to find some place for you to go." I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "This place is for alcoholics. And you were in this meeting tonight, and we could feel your pain and the struggle that you're going through, but we're all alcoholics, and we didn't know what to do or say to you to help you. We're going to have to find a place for you to go." And he says, they asked me, he says, "Are you an alcoholic?" I says, "I don't know." He says, "Well, have you ever had a bar tab?" I said, "Yeah, I had three of them." He said, "You can stay." So then I just opened a whole new can of worms. You know, all of a sudden I'm starting to look at all the alcohol problems that I never even looked at. And then I was so excited about being in there, and I didn't have anything to worry about. I just focused on my recovery, and I stayed in for about 6 months. And Brad, one of the biggest things I ever benefited from, and one of the things I'd heard around here forever, you can't think your way to sober living, you got to live your way to sober thinking. Well, that baffled the shit out of me. You know, I didn't understand it. And he came, there was 12 of us guys in the house. He came in the Big Book Stadium and held his book up. He said, "Now, if you want to, I'll take all you guys, load you up in the van. We'll go over here to Joe's Tavern. And there'll be a guy in there, his name happens to be Joe, and he'll be sucking down his tall neck Budweiser." And he was a proud member of Alcoholics Anonymous for years, state delegate and all this. He knew this book like the back of his hand. He knew it word for word. But Joe drank again. So Joe knew the book very well, but was incapable of applying it. And then that day I understood what that meant about thinking, I try to think my way sober. And that day and that moment, I realized if I was going to get sober, that I chose to start working the steps of this program. And then when I left there, I was so excited about my recovery that I was just getting more concerned about going back to work. I followed some other friends. Finally went to DAC. They accepted me there for their 30-day outpatient program. And while I was there, it's this outpatient program, this doctor came in giving us lectures on medication. You know, and the thing, he talked to us about alcoholism. You know, once we get alcohol in our system, no longer we have control of it. And I was that way. Once I put alcohol in my system, whether it be a cap full or a bottle full, there's just no telling what's going to happen and where I'm going to end up with a naked woman or up in a tree or wherever I'm going to end up. And I'm going to end up somewhere not from where I started. I know. And so, and he says, you know, it's okay for us to take medication based on our spiritual condition. And another thing that changed in my recovery, now I'm full of questions. I want to know, and my understanding of that at the time was that I had to be in some spiritual place with some spiritual connection with God. And so I asked the doctor if my understanding of that was correct. He says, hell no, Vaughn. He says, it doesn't mean that. He says, all that means is that you think you can take that medicine like it's prescribed. You know? So he had a chalkboard up there, and he started writing on the chalkboard, and the first thing he wrote on there was sniffle, 48% alcohol. And for me, when he wrote NyQuil on there, I said, damn, I'm an alcoholic. The way that stuff's prescribed to take is a little cap before bedtime, not the whole 16-ounce bottle. <Yeah. laughs> I see fighting it. You know, and we was at a first state meeting Friday night. And at the end of it, stopping drinking and using was not easy for me. You know, and I think this has been very important. It talks about during the first step that we stood at a turning point. You know, and I can remember days when I thought that I could not go another moment without drinking or drugging. People gave me their phone numbers and they'd say, call me. And I'd call somebody and let them know what I was going through. And Farris would be my first sponsor. And he'd always tell me to go over to this detox unit over here that you spill from broccoli. I wanted this craving of alcohol. When's this going to ever leave me? Pray to God, when every day I have to sit and fight these cravings, are they going to ever go away? So he said, go up there, and he said, big fat lady, come answer the door, tell her that you're craving drugs and alcohol, and you want to talk to some drunks. So I go in and ring on the bell. She'd come in. Of course, I look like Charles Manson. They'd let me come in that place. And I go in, and I don't know what the magic of all this is, but I go in there, and she'd bring some drunks in there, and we'd sit in the lobby, and we'd talk for a little while. And the thought of drinking and drug left. I don't know what the magic of that is. But I had prayed to God for help for the longest time. And for me, you know, I kept thinking God's going to shoot some bolts of lightning down and change my ass. And I was at my home group, the Skyline Group. Been going there for 25 years now. And I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Is the day I was sitting there at Skyline, realizing I really didn't know nothing. And I felt comfortable not knowing I didn't know nothing. Because everything I'd done up to there in my life had put me through hell, my parents through hell. And I know that I had been praying to God for help. And for some reason, I looked around in that room, and I was at a meeting that night. There must have been 300 people in that meeting. And I realized God had answered my prayers, and I looked around that room, and I was surrounded by help. There's over 300 people in there. So I came to believe that it's something I had not done. The reason why I struggled, I think, for so long was I just cleaned up and showed up. But I had to start letting people in the program in my life and let people know what I was going through and let people help me get sober. And when people would share with me how they got through situations, and the faith I got, the faith is following through with suggestions that people gave me. And by doing so, eventually for me, it was my prayer come true, was to be free from the obsession of drinking and use drugs. And I went on in and, you know, finished doing my fourth step and fifth step. And for me, I'd always thought I had to get good to get a relationship with God. And I was wondering, because I wasn't getting good, but I wasn't drinking. But after I did my fourth step, then did my fifth step, and looking at how much my life had changed then, that I realized in my fifth step that God loved me as I am. And then a lot of my recovery from that day on was me trying to learn to love me. And then from there, me trying to love you. And then the rest of the steps is me trying to love what I do. And I think one of the steps I enjoy the most has always been my 10th step, which is a daily thing. But the perseverance is the principle behind that. The perseverance is that is when I was at my very bottom. Is when I say that when tomorrow looks worse than today. My mind was always on yesterday or tomorrow and never could focus on what I was doing today. And I tell you, it's just so much of a blessing today to be able to live in the day and not worry about after I've cleaning up the wreckage of the past. And living right and doing right, that ain't a whole lot of the moral I've got to worry about. But I'm going to end with one thing here. I've run over. I think I'd like to share this, and then I'm going to close. When I was in my third year of sobriety, my mother was dying. And all the medicine in the hospital could not free her from the pain that she was living in. She was suffering from cancer. She had it all in her brain. She had it in her bones. I couldn't even sit on the edge of the bed and hold her hand. She hurt so bad. And she comes telling me about how proud she was of how I had changed my life. And at this time, I was in the process of buying my first home, my home I have. Had small construction businesses started. And just everything was just blessed with all sorts of things. And she had seen me become what she had hoped she had seen her son become. And she wanted me to promise her that I would never go back to where I used to live. And I promised her that. And I said, Mom, there ain't no way I'd ever go back to that. And she wanted to know how I had turned things around. And I told her about the time we was in that alley. You know, I said, Mama, I said, you know how I told you one time it would take an act of God for me to ever change? And she says, well, yeah. And I said, well, Mama, I didn't do too good a job with my life. I've brought pain and suffering to me and everybody around me. And this program I got through helped me to find a God I don't know, I understand, and I gave my life over to the care of God because I got tired of running it. And then there was a smile come from her, and she come up out of that bed in all the pain that she was in and hugged me like she had never hugged me before. And she said, "Yeah, son, there is a God." I said, "Yeah, Mama, there he is." And later on she died. And another thing with that, drugs and alcohol, it took from me the ability to care about you, anybody, or anything. And so I took my daddy back to his apartment. I was thinking only of my losses and what I've lost, you know. And I opened the door to his apartment, and I was able to feel his loss. And his pain was much greater than mine. You see, I wanted to try and talk him into coming and staying with me for a week or two so he could overcome his grieving, you know, and he didn't want to come. So I chose to stay with him, you know, and I realized that the ability to care had been stowed back into my life. Anyway, I've never been good at talking. I always talk too long. My first sponsor shared with me, and I've hoped I've lived one of the main ingredients in being in his sobriety, and it has so much been in mine, is to maintain an attitude of gratitude. You ever forget where you come from, you repeat it. And I know for many years around here, the man I talked to on the telephone, I made that first phone call, was sitting here at NAVA some 22 years ago. And they were the one phone volunteers on the phone line. You know, and I was incapable of volunteering for anything. So he volunteered for me. He said, "Vaughn," he says, "you ought to work on that phone line." And I said, "Well, hell, Bill," I said, "what can I possibly tell him?" He says, "Well, in your case, the less you tell them, the better off they'll be." Yeah. You know, but I worked on that phone line for 22 years. Now, I don't want to forget that phone call I made. You know, but something that just blesses my heart more than anything I've ever experienced here. And 99% of the time when I was on that phone, it was always somebody wanting directions to meet and find some place to go. You know, but every now and then I'd get that one person who didn't think he could stop drinking and drugging. And I'm so grateful today that I can tell them I did. It's always been the same. They want to know how I did it. I'll tell them a little bit about my past and how I got here, and a little bit about this fellowship. And ask them if they think they'd be interested in getting to this meeting. And they'd generally always, "Yeah." I said, "Well, I'm going to have a couple of guys meet you there." You know, and I don't know whatever happens to those people. But all I can honestly say I ever did is one day I showed up in an AA meeting. And I loved what I seen. I still love what I seen. And I'm just thankful to be suffering. And thanks for y'all letting me be here and share it. And apologize for running over. Thank you, Ron. Now, for one, I'm glad you did run a little over, but if you have to leave in a hurry, that's great, but we're going to give out chips, and Tinsley, would you come up?
name is Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic. Here at this meeting, we have a chip system to mark our time away from our last drink. If you'd like to try what this program has to offer, stay sober one day at a time. We offer a white chip. Anyway, I'd like to pick up a white chip. All right, after 30 days, we have a silver chip. About 30 days. Red chip for 90 days. Anybody got 90 days? There's a yellow chip for 6 months. Anybody want to pick up 6 months? Green chip for 9 months. Any birthdays? Anybody want to reconsider on a white chip? Big hand for the chips you hold.
Do we have any AA-related announcements? Yes, Julie.
There's going to be a memorial service party at Cathedral Towers. If anyone needs directions, I can give them to them. Saturday the 19th at 3 o'clock.
3 o'clock Saturday at Cathedral Towers. Leonard Cotton Gim, Jr. Cotton.
Who used to come
here on a regular basis, and when he shared, he would always say he was the most important person in the room because he was staying sober by coming. So we're going to miss him. Yes, Rock is coming up. Yeah.
Hey, Martin. I'm home.
Hey, Martin. Okay, the Atlanta Men's Workshop is going to be March 25th. Through the 27th, and Frank, if you have any specific questions about the workshop, he's here, but there are still openings available, not many, but that's a great time for the guys. Working 12 steps. If you've got sponsees, consider sending them there. And if you want to hang out for a little bit after the meeting and help us clean up, we'd appreciate it. So that is welcome. And yeah.
And I'm going to run the past the basket skim. If you can, unless you get a chance, I'll put the basket on the table and we'll hear at the door. The dispensers are
on. Okay. So, anything else? I'd like to remind everyone that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions that remind us to place principles for personalities. And for those who will, please join us in the Lord's Prayer.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us, and lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. And thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Hey, Paul, would you sign people's seats?